of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and resistance to Israeli apartheid. Radio Free Palestine. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to ask you right now to support Democracy Now! On WBAI without commercial interruption or interference. Let us hear from you now by calling our pledge line at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We're partnering with WPFW in Washington, D.C. and KPFK in Los Angeles, as well as radio stations and producers across five continents with analysis and discussion, speeches, music, poetry, and updates from student encampments. The number is 212-209-2950. Back to Radio Free Palestine.
Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's us.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
Like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger on! What's the foul?
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to a special episode of The Collision. He's Chuck Modiano, I'm Dave Zirin, and today's program is part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents. Nakba, of course, is Arabic for catastrophe. And it marks May 15th, 1948, when 750,000, and that's a low number, Palestinians were violently displaced from their land to create the modern state of Israel. And we mark this day not just because it was a human rights catastrophe, but because, as Macklemore says in his track, Heinz Hall, the Nakba never ended. And in just a few minutes, we're going to bring on Professor Will Laffey Yeomans. Now, if you don't know who Will Yeomans is, he is a professor at George Washington University, and he was a leading faculty member at the encampment at GW, which frankly electrified the city of Washington, D.C. We want to talk to him, and he's coming on real soon. But first, we have a few minutes before Will Yeomans comes on the show, and I want to talk to my man Chuck Modiano. Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How about you, DZ?
I'm great. It's an honor to be part of this show. You know, it's so interesting. I was thinking about that phrase from the Macklemore song about the Nakba never ended. And yesterday in the news, I don't know if you saw this, Chuck, but there was this absolutely heart-wrenching sight of Israeli settlers right by the Gaza wall in an area, in a settlement called Sidarat, cheering for settlements in Gaza, cheering for more Israeli housing to be built in Gaza, chanting for this while smoke rose in the background from the bombs that had fallen on the other side of the wall. And that's when I felt how true those lyrics really are, that the Nakba never really ended. So we're commemorating what occurred in 1948, but we're also drawing attention to what is an ongoing process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe his next line is that is the colonizer lied. And that's true as well. Nakba never ended. The colonizer lied. And the colonizer lied to me growing up Jewish because I never knew about a Nakba. I was never taught about a Nakba. I don't know if this is because my parents lied to me or they were lied to, but this wasn't part of my education. I had to discover that in the last 10 years, sadly, at Free Palestine rallies. Been covering Free Palestine rallies since 2014. I learned that at the Free Palestine rallies as a grown adult. So, you know, we have a problem with the education system. We have a problem with our media. But, you know, I loved the GW protests, the amazing protesters. And then, you know, you mentioned Will is coming on. Him and I met about 50 faculty who were part of those protests, not just from GW, but from all the DMV, from Howard, from Georgetown, from many of the other universities who stood in solidarity at potential risk to themselves. And that's the kind of solidarity we need, because if we're going to call ourselves an educational institution and we're going to say this is a place of higher learning, then at least we have some faculty who are embodying that, if not the administration.
No, absolutely. A sector of the faculty in this city stepped up. And that's one of the things I want to talk to Will about is, did what happened at GW, did the presence of the encampments actually change the faculty on that campus going forward? Or was this a one-off thing, or are we going to see a more engaged faculty in student activism? And of course, I also want to ask Will what we can do right now to help the student activists who are currently facing all kinds of charges for daring to raise the issue of divestment. And that's something I want to say too, Chuck, before we bring Will Yeomans on, is that people need to realize that more progress has been made on the issue of divesting from the Israeli war machine in the last month than in the last 10 years of activism around BDS and the modern boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. More progress in the last month than in the last 10 years. I will defend that statement, lock, stock, and two burning barrels, because let me tell you something. Protest works. Marion Barry of D.C., former mayor, used to say the squeaky wheel gets the grease, which is kind of a crude way to say that when you raise hell, you can bring heaven down from the skies and actually wrest a degree of justice from this system.
That's exactly right. Protest works. And when it doesn't, it's because it wasn't long enough and it wasn't strong enough. And right now we're seeing long and strong protests that must continue. I wanted to add to your previous point about faculty, a note in D.C. If people remember Howard University, the young people were in encampments 2 years ago protesting the terrible conditions of housing on campus. And while that maybe didn't lead to major changes, later on, months later, adjunct faculty protested their meager salaries. I was just shocked at how little adjunct faculty got. But what turned it over is that Howard could not afford another cycle of terrible media now that the faculty came out. So the win that came out of the adjunct faculty, because there was a win there and those salaries were significantly increased, thank the students for that. The students laid the groundwork. Some faculty joined the students and those young people gave the courage and inspiration for the faculty. So there's a little bit of history here of young people leading the way.
Excellent. And, I think we have Professor Will Yeomans on the line. Will Yeomans is an associate professor at GW School of Media and Public Affairs. He He's also the director of the Institute of Public Diplomacy and Global Communications at GW. And he was also a leading faculty member at the Encampment at GW, which, as I said, electrified this city here in Washington, D.C. Thrilled to have him on. Will Yeomans, how you doing, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a thrill. And I know our time with you is limited, and there's so much I want to know. First, if you could answer us just like big picture, what do you think the encampments, not just in D.C., but, you know, across the land, what do you think the encampments have taught us as a movement, as a resistance struggle? What have the encampments done? What have they accomplished?
You know, they're historically unprecedented. We've never seen such a vibrant effort across the whole country to bring Palestine to the front of the agenda. And I think that that's a major step forward for the Palestine Solidarity Movement. You know, there was almost probably, I would say, zero hope that this kind of camp, mass camp movement would happen, you know, just a few years ago. You know, of course, it does take a horrific genocide in Gaza to spring that forward. But just the fact that these youth are not restrained by the same sort of inhibitions that older generations have developed around this issue, you know, a fear of speaking out, gives us so much hope.
Mm. Now, I'll let Chuck, you jump in whenever you like. I have my raft of questions here.
Yeah.
The crackdowns, Professor Yeomans, is so shocking to me. Like the degree to which, you know, they went after these encampments with tear gas, with arms, with brutality. You know, I'm not just talking D.C. I mean, the examples all over the place where my daughter goes to school. They arrested 103 people like it was nothing. Why so threatened by these encampments? Why has the response been so vicious and ferocious?
You know, universities are under a lot of pressure. Whether from state legislators or politicians or donors, alumni, some conservative faculty, and by conservative, I also mean liberal faculty as well, by some students who are afraid that the protests will grow and disrupt their commencement. So there is a lot of pressure on these institutions, but, you know, for them to meet nonviolent protests through police force and violent action, I mean, is scandalous. And it's something that really these universities should be held accountable for, those that called on the police and the police forces as well. I mean, need to be held responsible. I mean, you had absurd scenes like in UCLA where these counter protests viciously attacked protesters for 3 hours while the police sat there and did nothing. And then the next day, the police used that as a pretense, along with the university, to disassemble the encampment. So you have a very clear institutionalized bias against Palestine solidarity activism that came out. I mean, thankfully at GW, we ignored that scenario because the police had the good sense to tell the university that they're not going to go along with the request to disassemble a peaceful settlement. And they said that the optics would be bad, and they were right. But eventually they did, after Congress became interested in shutting down the encampment. They started to put pressure on the D.C. mayor. Nothing had changed. The camp was still nonviolent. So all the reasons that the police had given for not taking down the camp 2 weeks prior, you know, all those reasons were still active. But they gave in to the political pressure.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I've seen you out there. I appreciate you and all the other faculty who stood with the young people since day one. And my question is, we know that very early on, six students were suspended or nearly right away in a little bit of a dirty trick to suspend them using their ID to get inside the hall. We know there have been repercussions. Has there been any pushback from a faculty perspective from either the administration or even some other faculty who may oppose you?
Yeah, you know, early on they put a fence right around the camp, and it was a pretty aggressive move, a little bit out of the Israeli playbook. And then when the students needed to use the bathroom, they had to be escorted by GW's police. And then when they tapped into the buildings to use the bathroom, that was the data that the university used as the basis for suspending students. And it's not only that they suspended them, but they started talking about charges that were extensive, you know, 2-year suspensions. I haven't seen anyone who's plagiarized on campus suffer that kind of penalty. Someone told me, I don't know if this is true or not, but that some of the sexual abuse or rape cases that get tried through the system sometimes don't even lead to those kinds of stern punishments. But there are, you know, there's an effort by faculty to push back on this. A lot of these processes are not really open. I mean, they are allowed to have an advocate present, like a quasi attorney present, and they do allow sort of testimony. So we're waiting to hear from the first round of suspension, you know, quasi trials or whatever they're called, these processes by the end of the week. Also, parents are pretty mobilized. I mean, the parents of the camp and campers are really upset with how the university did not negotiate immediately to bring a peaceful resolution and instead used police and harsh sanctions.
Mm. How much does that matter, the parental intervention in all of this? It seems like the GW administration is remorseless in how they're moving forward. Can that be a pressure point?
You know, I think that there's always a risk when you alienate too many parents, especially when they're like of one sort of demographic group. Like, is GW going to be able to, you know, recruit students of Arab and Muslim background when, you know, so much of the official rhetoric around this issue has been dehumanizing of Palestinians? You know, after October 7th, they put out a very strong statement condemning the atrocities of October 7th. But then as, you know, Palestinian casualties piled up and Israelis demolished and destroyed Palestinian universities, the university didn't make any statement. So there's been this like inherent dehumanization that is going to alienate a lot of prospective students and their families as well. And some of the parents are talking about transferring the students out because of the harsh university response. But you have to keep in mind that there's also students who are pro-Israel and their parents are putting a lot of pressure on the university in the other direction. But ultimately, the university shouldn't be playing a popularity contest. It has to act right according to principles. And, you know, the claim that the camp was disrupting the university is a joke. The university is, you know, at least, 12, 15 blocks, and there's a student camp in the middle of one block. I mean, everyone, my class went perfectly fine, and my class was across the street from the camp. It concluded perfectly fine. Exams that were too close to the site were able to be moved. That's a minimal disruption. So the narrative that the university's painted around the camp is completely false. And the students were very, very disciplined, at least. I mean, they tried to discipline what people were saying. So if anyone was putting up a sign that was inappropriate, they took it down. There were some videos that emerged that the university has tried to paint the picture that there was like this anti-Semitism in the camp, you know, totally ignoring all the Jewish students who were part of the protest movement. But there were like a lot of bad faith efforts by provocateurs to get reactions, and it's minimal, you know, it's not there. And so to say that the camp was somehow unsafe for pro-Israeli students or Jewish students is a joke. And I think it has to do with the narrative around safety that campuses have used. Mm-hmm. Oh, everyone's got to be safe. And it's really bled into, the speech that is just uncomfortable for individuals is somehow a threat to their safety. And this is something that conservatives were piping about a few years ago. Of course, they're completely absent on this issue now.
The irony of that has been blaring, the whole conservative push for free speech on campuses from a year or two ago, and then their reaction to this.
Yeah.
Sorry, Chuck. Go ahead, sir.
No, it's good. But to your point, we've seen all the free speech frauds come out who've been claiming free speech all these years until they don't like that speech. So there's that. I wanted to know, this is a campaign for divestment, that specifically in these universities and all of the 9 DMV coalition universities in the coalition all have issues with their administration, heavily engaged with the Department of Defense or these weapons manufacturers. Do you, from your perspective, see light at the end of the tunnel to get actual divestment, whether GW or some of these other universities, that we may be seeing elsewhere around the country?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, one issue is that the encampment was at GW. So that puts more pressure on GW than the other universities.
Yeah.
I think a place like Georgetown, which has a, you know, this Jesuit tradition, and they've tried to make good on the whole slavery legacy and on that university campus. I mean, that's a very different kind of philosophy than some of the other universities. And I think GW is going to be the most reluctant place just because of the constitution of the Board of Trustees, who are ultimately the decision makers on these things. But I think the door is open and this issue is not going away. This encampment is a major boost to the local, you know, to the student organizers who have been pushing forward on this. And their first request is disclosure, and disclosure is almost like they have to give it. I mean, it's just such an obvious request for investment transparency. I mean, it's just like within what they teach at the business school around corporate social responsibility, business ethics. It just seems like they're going to be able to get that as a bare minimum this year. And then from there, they could build towards divestment. I think that there is a sea change with this generation, especially in that Israel apartheid and the inherently violent nature of it is completely exposed. I think there's no going back from that, and the future generations are going to be even more in solidarity with Palestine. So I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, I was involved in the student divestment movement 22 years ago, and I never imagined that it would get this close, even within the 20 years, just given the power of the pro-Israel lobby and how embedded pro-Israel bias is in our institutions and our government.
No, it is remarkable how even, you know, 18 years, 19 years since you were a student activist, it was one thing. And now with it feels almost like a snap of the fingers. We're in this completely new reality with regards to divestment in these discussions. How do we and I'll say my experience in talking to people at encampments has been been really impressed with the political sophistication, the strategic sophistication, the tactical sophistication, and the focus of saying, don't look at us, the protesters. Look at what we're protesting. Look at what's happening in Gaza. Look at what's happening in Rafah. It's been so incredibly impressive. How do we understand the sea change, Will? Is it just about the brutality of the Israeli state? Is it, I mean, some people will say it's how young people are getting where they're getting their news from, breaks out of the typical matrix that they've been in. How do you understand your generation of students right now?
You know, I think that, you know, the digital technology does play a part just in the fact that students can quickly see images from other campuses and quickly interface with other activists. And so the possibility of contagion just is more likely than my day, which was kind of like email listservs. And, you know, like we couldn't move like videos very easily online. So we couldn't see what was happening on other campuses easily, but also just what was happening on the ground in Palestine and the way that Gaza was able to speak for itself through digital technologies in ways that, you know, we just didn't have that ability two decades ago. So I always felt like it was hard for us to operate as a solidarity movement when the lines of communication with those who were in solidarity with the actual Palestinians was kind of narrow and limited. It still happened through various ways, but it was all kind of slow. Here, like kids these days are just so much more, as you said, sophisticated, savvy. They learn very quickly from each other. They also are not inclined to just believe mainstream media. They're used to sort of doing, having the capacity to do their own research, as they say. And then I would also say they just have grown up in a different time. Like even if you look at children's books nowadays, they're much more humanistic, much more progressive generally than like what we kind of were brought up on. So I think that there's just like a generational change being driven by so many different factors. And the great thing about students is they're kind of naive about traditional power. They haven't internalized all the limitations that those of us who've been through the ringers have somewhat internalized. So we see limitations but students, youth always see possibility. And that's really one of the few hopeful things about this country and this issue.
We got time for a couple more questions, and I have about 67 of them. Chuck, anything burning from you?
Well, just I want to add, you know, yesterday Biden advanced $1 billion in arms for Israel while all of the genocide is going on in Rafah. So we just got to put that out there. But I think I wanted to ask, what have you – I've been inspired by the students. I've learned a lot from the students. What have you taken away from the last couple of weeks at GW that may have changed you a bit, inspired by the students?
You know, it's pretty much what you said, which is, you know, I've been telling faculty this, is that we can actually learn a lot from them. I think a lot of faculty, because we're so used to lecturing them and teaching them, you know, we try to do discussions, or we hear students' viewpoints and that kind of thing. But we're focused on these kind of academic matters that, you know, do require years of training and exposure to really understand. So it was a major pivot for a lot of us to sort of be in a position where we kind of had to sit back and follow their lead and see what they were saying. And of course, they make mistakes. We would make mistakes if we were in their position as well. I mean, what they're doing is against the odds. So really it was kind of humbling from that professorial vantage point to see that the students are really well equipped. But what is interesting is that some of them would go up to faculty and they would say, you know, we learned about about social justice in your class. And, you know, so they kind of use that opportunity to also speak back to the faculty, and they're disappointed in the faculty who teach on these things, but didn't turn up as not practicing what they preach in a way, or just limiting it. And there's a lot of fear among faculty about repercussions, especially junior faculty or adjunct or otherwise precariously employed faculty, because we've had cases of faculty members being fired for being outspoken on this issue across the country. But look at these students. I mean, they're so vulnerable. They have almost no leverage vis-a-vis a powerful, rich university. But they're not afraid. And so that's really the most inspiring thing, is not having any fear to speak out in this time where their voices are more needed than ever.
No doubt about that. You know, gosh, where to go? I have a little time with you, and I've got all these questions. Got to ask you this. Has this changed in some way the faculty at all at GW in terms of the relationships you have with each other? Closer, more activist-minded, more agitationally minded, more thinking about how to take the lessons from the classroom into the streets, more attentive to the needs of the students? Have you felt that change? Are you closer with some members on the faculty than you were before this all started? Ooh.
Yeah, I met more faculty at the camp than I did probably in my 12 years at the university. We've become very siloed, you know, and stuck in our routines, but this forced our new concentration. And then people turned up, and I was like, oh, I didn't know. I didn't know that they had good politics. So it was kind of refreshing to see. And we'd been so demoralized in our isolation, many of us, especially by the institution's lack of response. You know, in early October, I pushed the administration to actually do events and forums and programming around this. But instead, it was like treated with this code of silence. And any discussion of this issue was met with fear, trepidation, backlash. And so it had been a very stultifying climate. But to see this really opened up the faculty's eyes to the possibilities around, you know, collective action, which faculty are not very good at collective action. We like make meetings longer than they need to be, and everyone likes to hear the sound of their own voice. So we're not prone to it, but I saw a new level of faculty organizing around a social justice issue that I have never seen at the university. So I think that could be something that has a longer term effect, and it will be because of the students, not because of the faculty.
Amazing. Chuck, we got time for you one question, me one question.
You got it, Doozy. You got it.
Oh, well, mine's the most basic one I could possibly ask. You've got these student activists out there, Professor Yeomans. They're facing pressure at the school. They could be facing criminal charges. What can we do as people who supported the encampment, who brought food to the encampment, who brought books to the encampment, and who don't want to pretend like, oh, it's over now, because now these students are living with the effects of having been part of the encampment, and yet you know, there should still be a role for us who want to help them and be in solidarity with them. What can we do?
I mean, I think the most important thing is to contact the institutions, the president's office, members of the boards of trustees, anywhere students are facing sanctions. The more public pressure that goes on the institution, the better, because surely they're hearing from the pro-Israeli organizations that mobilize these voices. So it's very important to counter that.
Excellent. Wow. You're going to have quite the situation on your hands when campus resumes this fall, Professor.
Oh, yeah.
Not just with this coming back, but with the elections as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be a hurricane, sir. Well, Professor Yeomans, is there anything else you want to add before we bid you adieu?
No, I just want to thank you for focusing a spotlight on the students and really following their lead on this. You know, what they're doing is just so crucial at this time. And we need to really be encouraging that and supporting that as much as possible.
Tremendous. Professor Will Yeomans, thank you so much for joining us on this very special day. Today's program is part of Radio Free Palestine. It's an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day today, May 15th. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Excellent. That was Professor Will Yeomans here on a very special edition of The Collision. You are listening to a 24-hour special on Nakba Day produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine, with the English stream, so proud to say, produced by WPFW. Radio Free Palestine continues after this break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this message.
Child deserves is God-given that right. Come under threat, it must be defended. You think Allah will see what you're doing to his children? Who's been held accountable? Who's in charge, mister? These kids ain't got nothing to do with y'all business. You should be building more schools in our prisons. They bomb the same, even make news in y'all city. He could have been a scholar, he dealing with different problems. Missile hit his home and crushed and killed his baba. We should be playing soccer or meeting up by lockers. He wanted to be a doctor, but he don't have those options.
That was really beautiful. You are listening to a very special episode of The Collision, part of our 24-hour special on Nakba Day, which is being produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine, with the English stream, so proud to say, produced by us here, WPFW. Shout out to Katia Stitt and the incredible work she did on all of this. Shout out to Dara Orenstein at GW University, who held it down with Will Yeomans and so many other brave faculty out there. Just incredible to see the work you all did. Chuck, I want to give you the chance, if you could, to reflect as someone who is very much supporting, recording, doing incredible work around the encampment yourself. I wanted to give you a chance to reflect on what Professor Yeomans had to say and how that jived with your experience being there and all the recording you did of the students, faculty, and activists who were out there in support of the encampment.
Yeah, and I was there day one at 6 a.m., and I interviewed Professor Yeomans out there, and he was the first faculty to give me an interview. There are about 10 GW faculty, and other faculty soon joined, one day up to 50 faculty. So, you know, really appreciate that from day one. He had a remark, and I want to illustrate or illuminate a couple of remarks just so everybody is clear. So one was about, you know, Jewish protesters and Jewish safety, and we're hearing a lot of lies. Not only are Jews a big part of these protests, but they're having Shabbat services during these protests. I interviewed a couple of individuals who belatedly had a bat mitzvah, three individuals as adults because people should know you have a bat mitzvah at 12. If you're a woman, 13. If you're a boy. And the reason that was, as one young lady told me, is that in her area where she lived and grew up, she didn't have access to anti-Zionist synagogues that were near her. Mm-hmm. So then a rabbi was there who was told this, and that rabbi said, well, you know what, we can make up for that. And that rabbi came back and did a bat mitzvah with three young women. And she said, I've never felt closer to my Judaism than ever before, and I've never felt safer as a Jew on this campus. This is what is going on. Yes, this is what is going on. I interviewed a Holocaust survivor on the campus who said, everything that happened to me as a child when I lost my parents in the Holocaust is happening to children in Gaza. I stand with you. This is the level of Jewish participation and integration. So when you hear these lies, they have no resemblance to what's actually happening in that encampment.
You know, that's something that I said as well early on. I was arrested at the Capitol soon after October 7th, calling for a ceasefire. It seems like at the time, I remember a dear friend of mine who's a Palestinian journalist saying there's no way this is going to go on to January. So we need to call for a ceasefire as soon as possible. And that was somebody who's a hard-bitten cynic on this issue, was thinking this is ending in January just because it would be, you know, just beyond the pale of cruelty to continue it that much farther. And here we are in May, you know, trying to stop a further, we have to say further, invasion into Rafah and the cost, the human cost that's taking place as we're doing this broadcast is more than I can put into words. Met someone just the other day who's a soccer coach here in this area who just lost dozens of members of their family over the many months, and lost members of their family in the bombings of Rafah. And it's just people, I don't think, who aren't dealing with it directly really have a sense of the immensity of the tragedy there, which again is credit I really do need to give these student protesters, because their constant reminder to people that it's not about us, it's about what we're protesting, was like a battle royal fight against the mainstream media. That all they wanted to do was talk about these student protesters and graduations and the lie about Jews being unsafe on campuses. And yet here the students are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, you think we're the story. We're not the story. The story is the brutality that you are not reporting upon. That level of focus, that level of, and it's also, let's be honest, that's about strategy and tactics as well, of a movement, never failed to impress me in my interactions with these young people.
Every protester centered it back to that. Let's talk about what you're not reporting on, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Rafah. So let's just do that for a second, because there are really two things that are said ad nauseum that are lies. Two words. One is Hamas and the other is hostages. That's all we hear. Well, what we know now is that another ceasefire was rejected, and that there have been multiple ceasefire with multiple opportunities. The first going as far back as October 9th, 2 days later, some have reported up to 10 deals that Israel keeps rejecting. And so to put it in the words of an expert in Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East, Omar Rahman, he had said to Al Jazeera, the last couple days have proved that Israel was not really negotiating in good faith. The moment that Hamas agreed to a deal, Israel was willing to blow that up by commencing their assault on Rafah. The goal is to destroy Gaza in its totality. And we have to be clear on that. If we know the facts, we know it has nothing to do with hostages, because hostages, Israeli hostages, are begging. They're protesting for a ceasefire in Tel Aviv right now.
Yeah, and the family members. Censored.
The family members. Thank you. privately, the hostages as well. But good point. The family members, they're begging for a ceasefire. They're the loudest proponents for a ceasefire. So everything we're hearing in America is pure noise, pure debunked, disproven noise. The goal is to conquer Gaza, take back the land, and complete a genocide. And we have to understand it just like that, because if you have any review of the facts, you know, the party line, the ADL line, the AIPAC line, it's all pure lies.
It is, absolutely. And this is what we're trying to expose here on Nakba Day. This is our 24-hour special produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine with the English stream. I'm so proud to say produced here by WPFW. You know, Chuck, and something else that Will Yeoman said that I want to really put a finger on is when he said that he met more members of the faculty at the encampment than he met just being a professor. And that says something to me about the industrial hedge fund nature of modern campus life.
Yeah.
I mean, basically what we're talking about, these are hedge funds where students happen to take classes. These are loan operations built on the backs of students. You know, that there's a degree of which where it's all just smoke and mirrors, you know, away from the actual issues that matter. And here, when you have struggle, what happens is that it clarifies all of that dramatically. Because it's not just about meeting faculty members that you'd never met before. It's not just about the incredible isolation that a lot of faculty members have to live in. It's also about the fact that, you know, struggle exposes how isolated you are in the first place. And bringing people together is part of what struggle does. And it just gives lie to this idea that, hey, you're in it on your own. If you can't make it on your own, then you're just screwed, blued, and tattooed. And it's like, well, no, our power comes from collective action. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from. And meeting other people, it's not just a side note or something to smile about. It's like, this is what it's all about. And I bet if you asked a lot of the students in the encampment, they would talk about like, yeah, I've made bonds in the last couple of weeks that usually take a couple of years. Or I've met people who I'm now going to know for life, who I didn't even know existed on this campus, who may have been invisible to me. You know, that's the part about it that's powerful. And I also think that that's the part that they fear. And, you know, when we talk about, like, why were the crackdowns so horrific, I really do think that's part of the answer, is fear of these students coming together. Because the last thing they want is students making demands to their hedge fund portfolios.
Right.
About what their hedge funds can and cannot be investing in, what they can't be investing in. That's why it's so impressive that on some campuses they are actually making progress on this. And it really says something, and that's very powerful. It's not just about the money that would be denied the Israeli state, the money being denied to foment this genocidal situation or this total war into Gaza. It's not just about cutting the strings and taking the money away. It's also about raising that idea of who should be in charge of the moral direction of a university in the first place. And that's something that school presidents, some of them, like at GW, have the attitude of, yeah, you can take this portfolio from my cold, dead hands. You know, this is not something I'm going to give up gently, because, you know, that's another source of pressure: trustees, donors, investors. And they fear them and they fear the students. And but when the chips are down and they have the choice of what side to stand on, we know what side they're going to stand with.
That's right. And DZ, first of all, I really appreciate your remarks, because you're really getting at, you're really talking about an integral point, and that the university itself has been exposed. Like, that is one of the byproducts. And it's really important to understand that when you're talking to students. I interviewed a young student, and all those who were suspended, and Professor Yeomans talked about the dirty trick of how they were suspended. Oh. They were told they could use their ID. That ID led to their data, and that data in the door to go to the bathroom was used to suspend them. And they had a camera as well showing those students as well, and they used that. And it was a dirty trick because they had a barrier that was out there keeping some students within the campus and others on the street at the time. So when you saw participants, I mean students, crush those barriers down and say, F your barrier, the backdrop to that is that they were using that barrier to end up forcing people to use their ID to go to the bathroom to then suspend them. And that was the first battle in the lack of trust of the administration and the students. So that's particular to GW. But to the larger university system, when you speak to that student, they say, I don't care that I'm suspended. I don't care that I'm expelled. And when you engage that question further, they're saying, why would I want to be a part of any institution that invests in genocide? They're rejecting the university itself. And it's really important to understand that in this context, that that's where the students' brains are. So when I see people on TV, oh, you're giving away your college education, I don't think they understand the depth of knowledge and the depth of resistance to this fraudulent capitalistic system that they're protesting. And that's huge. And I want to say one last thing.
Please.
Okay. In 1961, 7.7% of the adult population were college graduates. So at that time, say in 1961, college was just a fringe thing. Very few people went to college. You did not need it for employment. There was public education that was K through 12. And what happened since then is now what used to be 9th through 12th grade to get obtain the majority of jobs now went to college. Some of that's artificial and classist and racist. That doesn't need to be there. We learned that during COVID when there were some restrictions. But the economy changed to a more knowledge-based economy. However, what didn't change is, whereas we used to say, okay, K through 12, that is public education should have now been free as a national security issue, as a national education issue from 4 years of college, what used to be the 9 through 12. So in other words, in 2021, 54% of the all adults from 25 to 64 had these college degrees. So 7.7% to 54% in around 50 years, the entire landscape has changed. And these universities, we're finding out, are not really being used to educate people, to uplift people, but were actually used to invest in genocide. And they see it. The adults may not see it, but the students do.
Well, that's, I think, what's so important. When you have students going on stage at Columbia University to accept their diploma and ripping them up in front of the crowds. Yep. I don't know if you saw that.
I saw it.
Or when you have somebody at the University of Texas where, you know, they sent in the shock troops on those protesters at UT Austin, and you have a student unveil a Palestinian flag as he collects his diploma, as people heckle him from the crowd. I think when those things happen, you have to realize that something very different is going on here. And right. I think what you just said is so important, because these students have a political understanding of the world, not just of Palestine, not just of Gaza, not just of Israel, but of the world.
Yes.
That makes these kinds of threats, frankly, an irrelevancy to them.
Exactly.
Like if someone said to me, I'm taking away your diploma because of your beliefs on Palestine, Israel, my response would be to say, well, that's because, you know, I don't care, because that diploma is then completely fraudulent, because we live in a society based on exploitation and oppression. And if this is somehow something that I'm not allowed to have because I call that out, well, then, you know, throw kerosene on it and throw a match for all I care. But, yep. but that's knowledge that I've gotten over the course of decades in the movement. Like, I'm in just such awe of people who are 21, 22 years old who get it. Yep. And who are saying, and I think the politics that they hold, which I think this is part of what the ruling class, whatever you want to call them, like has such fear about, the politics that they hold are, the way I would describe it, is anti-colonial. And when they are anti-colonial, and when they're anti-colonial, that doesn't just apply to Israel, Palestine, Gaza. They're looking at indigenous people in the United States. They're looking at the transatlantic slave trade. you know, they're looking at every aspect of Western expansion and Western imperialism and putting it all together. And as one of these, you know, rich Harvard guys said recently, I saw this interview with him. He said, and I thought this was so illustrative, Chuck. He said, you can't get people to pick up a gun and fight for a country that you think is built on racism and oppression. And he was saying that as a concern. Like, how are we going to have standing armies if people think that what they're defending is inherently corrupt? And it's like, well, yeah, that is the problem now, isn't it? Like, it's hard to have a functioning imperial country if the people inside that country think you're completely full of it.
Exactly.
And, you know, and they face this in Vietnam, too, like this broad mass disillusion. And it took them several decades to get over what they called the Vietnam syndrome. It took until Bush's Operation Desert Shield, 1991, the elder Bush, till the U.S. was able to like mobilize the country for the sake of war. Not that dirty wars didn't happen in the 70s and 80s. Of course they did. But as far as like getting the actual country to mobilize and be, and, you know, tying yellow ribbons around the old oak tree and having parades, that took 20 years. I always say to people that the Vietnam syndrome saved more lives than the polio vaccine, because it kept the U.S. from going into these countries and killing tens of thousands of people or more. You know, it saved lives. Now, could we be looking at a Palestine syndrome about the U.S. funding regimes like this? I think that's what they fear.
Yes.
And I think that's what these students have brought to the table.
They've brought that to the table. They've exposed everyone. They've exposed educators. They've exposed the politicians. They've exposed the universities. They exposed friends and family. We know where you stand now. No more hiding. No more wiggle room. And just to put a fine point on your correct, very correct point, that it's anti-colonial in nature.
In nature.
The final night before the police, that a police tore down the encampment, and I was there till 1 a.m. And the only reason I stayed a couple of hours till 1 a.m. was like I saw a couple police cars that were posted up, a couple extra ones, and I said, this didn't look right. I was about to leave at 10:30. I'm like, this didn't look right. Let me hang till 1, and I've been kicking myself because I leave at 1, and then they move in at 3:30. But, there were some irregularities. But prior to me leaving, around 11 p.m. to 1 p.m., when the last activity of activities and political education that was going on every single day in that encampment, you had movie screening. And there was a movie screening. There were about 50, 60 people on the lawn looking at a movie. And that movie was The Battle of Algiers. That is the last activity that happened before the encampment was torn down. The Battle of Algiers, the 1966 film taken by the rebels during the Algerian War.
Yeah, and Pontecorvo, of course, did that film, brilliant film. It also did a film called Burn with Marlon Brando, which gets much less, shall we say, burn, and that people should see. I think one of the things that we're seeing is these students are watching films like The Battle of Algiers and applying it to their lives. It reminds me of some of the football players who tried to unionize, and one of them said they did it because they took a labor class at school. Mm. And it's like, as soon as these students start trying to apply their lessons, they're learning lessons far beyond the classroom. But I digress. We only have a couple minutes left, Chuck. So I wanted to ask you real quick before we had to go, what do you see happening in the city today or in the next couple days? How can people plug into any kind of activism? I've got an event I want to push. Therefore, I'm asking you.
I mean,
if
they went right now, in about 7 minutes, there's going to be a protest of federal workers at the White House. So federal workers are gathering at 10 a.m. 7 minutes from now, 6 minutes from now, at the White House. And that'll be going on, and I imagine there's going to be some a few other things going on in Nakba today. But the huge rally, the huge anniversary of Nakba will be this weekend, on Saturday, the national rally. Unfortunately, I'll be out of town because I got to attend a nephew's graduation elsewhere. But if you're in D.C., try to come to this rally on Saturday. It'll be a monster one.
Amazing. And next Thursday at the 14th Street Busboys and Poets, that's next Thursday, which means the 23rd of May, I'm going to be emceeing an event there where we show the movie Occupation of the American Mind, a film that's been banned at Montgomery College, banned at Jackson Reed High School. And we're going to do a panel afterwards about the state of the moment and why films like this are seen as so radioactive. And I'm very excited about that.
I'm excited about it.
Oh, please come, Chuck. Mary Beth Tinker is speaking, legendary activist from the Vietnam era. High school students are going to be speaking. The producer of the film is going to be speaking. It's going to be absolutely tremendous. Well, it's time for us to go on this show. You've listened to a special episode of The Collision, produced here on Nakba Day, produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine with an English stream produced by WPFW. I mentioned her name before, but I'd be very remiss if I didn't thank Katia Stitt here at the station for facilitating all of this. Just much respect to Katia for that. For Chuck Modiano, I'm Dave Zirin. Thank you for listening to this very special episode of The Collision. We are out of here.
WBAI New York, we're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you, Dave Zirin, and certainly thank you, Katia Stitt, the program director at WPFW, our sister station in Washington, D.C. Radio Free Palestine, Wednesday, May 15th, is the 76th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and resistance to Israeli apartheid. We're broadcasting programs from radio stations and producers across five continents, as you've been hearing, with analysis, discussion, speeches, music, poetry, and updates from student encampments. And you heard that quite a bit during the program that just left the air, Dave Zirin and Chuck Modiano, The Collision. I'm Michael G. Haskins, and I am asking you to help support this radio station, this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station. The Pacifica Foundation, which WBAI is part of, was launched by pacifist Lou Hill in 1949 with the first-ever listener-funded radio station. The Pacifica mission called for radio that would foster understanding amongst nations and individuals, encourage creativity, and promote the innovative, uncensored distribution of news. That's what you were just listening to. That's what you are going to hear the rest of the day until midnight, 24 hours of this programming with WPFW. And here at WBAI, we're asking you to become members of the station, to become a sustaining member for as little as $15 a month, helping to shore up this station, make sure that we know how much the funds that we have each and every month. Become that sustaining member, that BAI buddy, or become a first-time subscriber to WBAI, a new member, by calling our pledge line at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Make your calls right now. The Nakba must be stopped, must be reversed. Where are you hearing that? Where are you hearing programming like this? 90 miles in all directions, terrestrially, through WBAI, 99.5 FM. Worldwide at WBAI.org. I want to hear from you now. Just take a few moments, if you are able to do so, to support this station, your station, your station. And I want to tell you that I am so proud of WBAI right now. I really am so proud of what we do. And I am even more proud of you, because you have kept us going since 1960. You think about that now. Since 1960, maybe it was your parent, your grandparent, that first listen to WBAI and say, you know what? I want to become a subscriber. Well, we're asking you to become a subscriber right now. In your name, in your children's name, the name of your university or high school or middle school, 212-209-2950 or online at WBAI.org. We have a dedicated website. It's give2WBAI.org. We're going to go back now to Radio Free Palestine here on